You are about to hear an XM Original podcast.
This is Bob Edwards Weekend. The statistics are gross in almost every sense of the word. 90% of the developing world's sewage is dumped untreated into oceans, rivers, and lakes. 2.6 billion people, that's 40% of the world's population, have no access to a toilet. 1 gram of feces can contain 10 million viruses, 1 million bacteria, 1,000 parasite cysts, and 100 worm eggs. Inadequate sanitation kills more people in developing nations than AIDS, tuberculosis, or malaria. It remains the number one health risk. Rose George has written a book about the world of human waste. It's called The Big Necessity. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on the show.
About those statistics, it's important to point out we hear that a child dies every 15 seconds from dirty water, but what is water dirty from? It's a lack of sanitation, right?
It's generally to be brutal, contaminated with human feces. It's not just water, it's generally dirty water, dirty food, really more a dirty environment. But yes, it's all due to inadequate or inexistent, in many cases, sanitation.
You did a lot of reporting for this book, and your research took you all over the world, but you began in the sewers of London. Why there?
Well, it's only about 2 miles from my house, for a start, and I'd never been down a sewer. I'd never considered going down a sewer, and it just seemed like a fun kind of hardcore way of entering into the world of sanitation, and it was fun. It was an eye opener. It was a bit of a nose opener. I met the flushers of London sewers, who are a very tight knit, small community of men, invariably men. I think there are no women working full time in the sewers, and they taught me a lot. And that was my first trip.
Flushers, they're called.
They are called, that's the old-fashioned name, they're called flushers. That dates from the 19th century when they used to have rakes and they would literally flush the contents of the sewers down towards the Thames, the river in London, our great river, where it would simply be put into the river with no particular treatment.
Before those sewer tunnels were built, London had on-site sanitation. Explain what that means.
That was generally a cesspool in the backyard. There's a very famous passage in Samuel Pepys' diary, who is known for writing about the Great Fire of London, but also in the world of sanitation is quite famous for what he wrote about his cesspool, or his neighbour's cesspool, in fact. He gave a sense of what it was like living in the 17th century, I think it was, in London, when he went downstairs into his cellar and put his foot into the contents of his neighbour's privy. So there were these cesspools, and every house supposedly had a cesspool, or every street or so. But they were seriously inadequate, and especially when population growth increased and London just got bigger and bigger, there simply weren't enough cesspools to go around. And also cesspool emptiers, these people who were called gong farmers, which comes from gunge farmers, it was their job to empty the cesspools cleanly and hygienically, and in the end their services became too expensive and people simply discharged all their cesspools into the poor, suffering Thames.
And then came the Great Stink of 1858.
The Great Stink of 1858, which is exactly what it sounds like. All this stuff going into the Thames obviously did not bode well for the noses of the metropolis. And it was a very hot summer, and there was simply too much stuff in the Thames, and it pretty much ground to a halt. And it was extremely smelly, so smelly that the Houses of Parliament, which still front the Thames, the MPs held handkerchiefs to their noses, were in the debating chamber, and the curtains were soaked in lime and chloride to try and mask the smell. And there was serious talk of moving Parliament to more salubrious quarters out in Richmond or somewhere. In fact, they didn't, but what the Great Stink did do, added to the fact that there were dreadful cholera epidemics all through that century. But I think it was the Great Stink that actually pushed our great politicians to push through a bill to build the sewers of London in a record-breaking 10 days. It was absolutely unheard of, and that's why London has our enormous, mighty sewer infrastructure.
People were literally throwing up on the streets, right?
They were, and there are arguments that perfume probably became popular because of the on-site sanitation of the cities such as London and Paris, and also perhaps high heels gained popularity because people were simply having to wade through filth on the street. And obviously, there's a very famous Hogarth illustration showing someone tipping a chamber pot out of the window, and this was quite common, and in fact gives us the expression loo in English, which we use shorthand for toilet or bathroom, and that comes from garde l'eau, which is look out for the water that's about to be tipped on your head.
Wow. So how did London get out of this mess?
Well, luckily we had an incredibly brilliant engineer called Sir Joseph Bazalgette, who, there were many great Victorian engineers, but Bazalgette is the least remembered, in fact, even though he probably did the most to expand our lifespan and certainly banished cholera from the streets of London. And he built this mighty network of sewers. No one actually knows how long they are, but it's probably within the greater catchment of London and, say, Reading, which is about 60 miles away, there's probably about 30,000 miles of sewers. And that's pretty enormous. I think Paris has about 6,000, New York less than that. So very mighty network, and it's kind of like a highway system underground. So there are sorts of B roads, as we call them, and A roads, and lesser sewers and trunk sewers, but all feeding together and using gravity to end up. At the time, Bazalgette simply discharged all the sewage into the Thames again. But about 20 years after that, he saw the light after a terrible steamboat disaster when people died, probably coughing from the sewage that was in the water, river water. Treatment plants were built at the outer reaches of the Thames and are still there today. So we owe him an awful lot.
Wow. Those of us who have the privilege like to flush and forget, but all that waste does not magically disappear, and that's where your story gets really dirty.
Well, it does, and in fact, I don't generally like to use the word waste. I know my book, it does have the subtitle Human Waste, I wasn't allowed to put anything else on the cover, but it's not necessarily waste. And in fact, when you look at what happens to, we'll call it waste for now, what happens to human waste in the UK and the US, for example, it's separated into liquids and solids. It's cleaned. The liquid is cleaned and discharged into a watercourse nearby. The solids actually end up as fertilizer. In the States, it's known as biosolids. And 70% of the US's sewage sludge or biosolids is applied to land, either in agricultural or reclamation situations. So it's not waste. It's not wasted. However, it does provoke a lot of debate in the United States about whether it's a good idea to put this product on the land, seeing as we do tend to put an awful lot of stuff down our sewers, not just pure human waste, but industrial waste, and then things that are in our own bodies, such as pharmaceuticals, pretty strong medicines. And there is debate about whether this is a good idea it's a good idea to be spreading this on our land and our food crops.
And 90% of the world's sewage ends up untreated in oceans, rivers, and lakes?
It's actually, I must apologise, it's 90% of the developing world's sewage ends up untreated. But having said that, the developed world is certainly not perfect, because those fantastic sewer systems, New York also has a wonderful one, they are crumbling for a start, because there is incredible underfunding of the wastewater infrastructure in the developed world, and they are also vulnerable to population. So in London, our sewers were built for 3 million people, and they were built with overcapacity because Bazalgette was such a wonderful engineer, but they now must serve about 10 to 15 million people, and the same happens in New York. So what happens is you have sewers easily overwhelmed by a short, sharp rainstorm, for example, and when that happens, then there's really nowhere for the water to go, and it simply has to be discharged as raw sewage into the watercourses, into the Hudson or whatever river or bay is nearby, and that's not ideal.
You write, of all the people of the world, the Chinese are probably most at home with their excrement. How so?
Well, the Chinese also would not call human waste waste, because they have been using it as fertilizer on their fields for about 4,000 years at least. And there is an argument from one eminent soil scientist that's the reason that their agriculture is still flourishing when other civilizations did die out, for example, the Maya or maybe Easter Island. I'm not saying that that's particularly because they didn't use human waste on their fields, but it may be a contributing factor to why Chinese agriculture is still healthy. Having said that, they have in the past used this human waste raw on the fields, and that's not a good idea because human waste can carry up to 50 communicable diseases. It is, in fact, a very potent weapon of mass destruction, which is why there is such a horrible death toll of children related to poor sanitation.
More than 15 million rural Chinese homes have been provided with biogas.
Biogas.
What's that?
Biogas is methane, is gas from human excrement, human and animal excrement, excreta, shall we say. This is a wonderful program. This is one of my favorite trips. It's a government-run program, and what it does is give a farming family, rural farming family in China, something called a biogas digester. This is like, it's an underground tank, it's sealed. And it functions somewhat like a human stomach. So the waste from the latrine and ideally a pigsty, because you need a certain amount of volume, this waste feeds into this tank where it digests like a human stomach. And then you can tap off the methane that comes off it. And it's used, it's a perfectly good cooking gas. So these Chinese farmers no longer have to go and chop down wood, contributing to deforestation. Women have a lot more free time because they're not off gathering wood. They have a free and pretty inexhaustible energy supply, so they're very content.
On the opposite end of the spectrum from China is India. You describe it as a fecal-phobic nation.
It is. Indian peasants, for example, are not comfortable with using, for example, human-generated biogas. They think it's unclean. Now, this is quite odd. They are a fecal-phobic country, but it's quite odd because of all the countries I visited, Indians live at the most close quarters with human waste because it's simply everywhere. The statistics in India are so stunning. 700 million people without toilets. So what they do is a practice called open defecation, which is what it sounds like. People will just do their business where they can, and if it's in the open, then it's in the open. So if you travel around rural India, and even in some cities, certain streets, certain times of day, you will see lots of, in the words of one journalist, bare bottoms doing what they must. And it's just absolutely endemic. And the surprising thing about the film Slumdog Millionaire, which many people encourage me to see because of its latrine scene, the surprising thing about that is that they're shown having a latrine. Now, that is actually very unlikely because the slums of Bombay, for example, which I visited, there are about 10 toilet seats to about 40,000 people in some cases. So the likelihood of them having access to any latrine is really remote.
What you've just done for tourism in India, it's not on my list anymore.
It is incredible, India. I always say India has got the best and the worst, and that applies to sanitation as well. It does have the worst sanitation statistics, but it has the most amazing activists and a history of activism about sanitation, which is just, there's nowhere else like it.
Well, it used to be the same in Japan, but it's different now, right?
Japan has undergone a very interesting toilet revolution in about the last 60 or 70 years. 60 or 70 years ago, Japan was a nation of squatters. They had pit latrines. They weren't very nice pit latrines, by all accounts. And yet, 70 years later, they are a nation of robo-toilets. The robo-toilet, the official name is a high-function toilet, and it looks like a regular toilet, but it's not remotely regular to the average American or Brit, because it always has a heated seat for a start. It can play you music. It has an inbuilt bidet nozzle. It can massage you, dry you. Some of the really advanced ones can test your blood pressure, test your urine. I think the only thing they can't do is read to you. But these are standard in Japan. 60-70% of homes have what's known as a washlet. That's the most common brand. And in fact, they're so standard that apparently some Japanese school children refuse to use regular toilets that don't have this inbuilt bidet nozzle function.
They're spoiled. So
very spoiled. But once you have used a washlet toilet, it's very hard to go back.
I'm talking with Rose George about her book, The Big Necessity, which explores something most of us don't like to think about, human waste and what to do with it. The Western system of sanitation uses huge amounts of two increasingly precious resources, energy and water, and we're running out of both. So what are some of the alternatives? Any eco-sewage solutions?
There's lots of ecological sanitation solutions. There is a robust composting subculture in the USA, where it's known as the humanure culture. There are all sorts of things you can do depending on what your local authority allows you to do. You can get a composting toilet that uses water. So this again is an on-site sanitation solution. So you're not necessarily hooked up to the local sewer infrastructure, so you can minimize the water, because the regular flush toilet is an absolute guzzler of water. It can use up to a third of a household's water supply. That's pretty significant. And though we're not losing that water, because we don't lose water, it goes around and comes around, but it does end up in a form, often, especially if it's just discharged into the sea, where it becomes very expensive to turn it into drinking water again. So it's very wasteful of cost and energy. But you can have a composting toilet, and you can just you can have a perfectly dry toilet where you just add ashes or sawdust, and there's no water at all. Now, that might take some getting used to, but I know that in Norway, I was speaking to one professor there. It's very popular in Norway, ecological sanitation, because a lot of people have holiday cabins near the fjords where the regulations are very strict, but there's no sewer infrastructure. And this professor was telling me that his little daughter, who had grown up using a composting toilet, so with no water whatsoever, then went to school and saw a flush toilet and was absolutely horrified and couldn't imagine what on earth the sense was of using water. So it's what you're used to. So I think we can change our system. I'm not saying that there's going to be some kind of revolution of the sewer infrastructure, because it's obviously in place and it works up to a point. But we can tinker with it and be more sustainable about it.
We learned from your book that urine actually contaminates sewer water much more severely than feces do.
Well, the trouble with urine is that it is nutrients. Sewage, human excreta, contains a lot of nutrients, nitrogen, potassium and phosphate. The trouble is that when you put these through the wastewater treatment system and then discharge them into the sea or the river system, you can actually suffocate water, the life out of water, because you unbalance the level of nutrients. And the trouble with urine is that it contains 80% of the nutrients. So it makes life quite difficult for these wastewater treatment managers, who are trying very hard to regulate the number of nutrients that they're expelling from their treatment plants, but they have this liquid urine that's got most of them in it, and yet it's all put together in one thing, in one substance, and so it just makes their life a lot easier. But there are, I saw in China a very interesting project of urine diversion toilets. Which urine diversion toilet is, the toilet panel looks normal except it's divided in two, so you do one bit in one bit and you do the other bit in the other bit, so you separate. It's called source separation. And that way you can collect the urine and you can maybe feed it into the wastewater treatment plant. You can load manage it better and you can just regulate things better. But as some Swedish eco-sanitation people says, it just makes no sense to mix what God separates.
And you write about positive developments in this. There are heroes of the sanitation movement.
There are plenty of heroes. They weren't very hard to find either. I actually found several of them at the World Toilet Organization Conference in Moscow, which was the first one I attended. And there are these people, I call them the sanitation foot soldiers, who are just trying to improve things in their own corner of the world. And these heroes, they can be anyone from, I write about the South Africa's National Minister of Intelligence, a man called Ronnie Kasrils, who used to be the country's water and sanitation minister, but actually became the first minister to dare to say that he was a minister for toilets. Most water and sanitation ministers concentrate on water because it's a lot easier. It's easier to go and do the PR, to stand in front of a nice clean water pipe gushing out nice clean water, rather than to go and stand in front of a latrine, which is a shame because a latrine will actually prevent more disease than simply supplying clean water. So there are people like Ronnie, the Minister of Toilets. There's Jack Sim, who runs the World Toilet Organization, and is beginning to be taken very seriously. He hangs out with people like the Prince of Orange, who is the UN Secretary General's sanitation advisor. There are the Indian sanitation heroes who I mentioned, Dr. Bindeshwar Pathak, who runs the world's only international museum of toilets, but also tries to do what Gandhi did and liberate untouchables from their horrible job by building public toilets and by trying to propagate an easier, simpler way of cleaning toilets so that they don't have to do this horrible job.
Anything we can do to help out? I mean, has working on this book changed your behavior in any way?
It has. I do tend to nearly walk into lampposts quite a lot because I'm always looking at manhole covers since I went down the sewers. I always put the toilet seat lid down since someone told me that wallpaper changes colour because every time you flush the toilet with the seat up, there is a fine spray of whatever's in the toilet which is expelled around the room. I probably wash my hands more assiduously. I did always wash my hands, unlike the students of the London School of Hygiene who I write about in the book, who 80% of whom did not wash their hands. And what else do I? I think that's. I don't put oil down the kitchen sink anymore. I would always wipe an oily pan and put the tissue in the trash can or something, because I've seen that oil underground in the sewers, it forms disgusting, horrible, huge blocks. It absolutely stinks. The flushers hate it. And it's just a dreadful idea to put it into the sewer system.
Well, thank you for this education.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye.
Rose George. Her book is called The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters. Next, a visit with...